Hello, hello everyone. This is Kim C, and you're listening to The Year of Underrated Stephen King. This is a literary book podcast where this university fiction teacher adores reading the underrated works of Stephen King, especially during the month of October. Hello, dear ones, and thank you for joining me to uncover today's episode, which is The Green Mile Part 5, Night Journey. But before we begin, please forgive the delay. I am so very sorry for the lapse in our regularly scheduled programming. My goal for the Green Mile episodes was one a week, typically on the Sunday before the new week begins. However, I love the month of October as much as the next person, but for fiction teachers, it is often a thick forest of student submissions. A very thick forest. I feel like I am in Washington Irving's upstate New York woods, and the Headless Horseman is coming after me unless I get my grading done. So these fiction submissions, they take time. Time, and a little more time on top of that. So I have a lot to do. I never ever, even though I'm tempted, want to push out pod episodes that I feel aren't, if it's not work I'm proud of and that I feel I've done my darndest to make it as rich and expansive as I can, I don't like doing that. Ergo, we have a little bit of a delay, but my hope is that the content of Kim C is worth the wait, that these episodes, it's okay if there's a little bit of a delay, if the kitchen does a good job cooking a delicious meal. But today, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, do we have an amazing chunk to discuss. Oh, wow. Oh, this story, folks. My gosh, okay. So, as I was compiling my notes today for Night Journey, The Green Mile, Part 5, I scribbled it at the top of my notebook, I found myself a little bit speechless. And as I was analyzing that, as I was looking deeper into why that is, this story is just unraveling itself to be more incredible with each iteration. And I'm a little breathless, and I mean, what this says about part 6, my god, you're gonna have to roll me up off the floor, you guys. That's my feeling, my thought, is my heart's just gonna explode in part 6 because this novel is so beautiful. Oh my goodness. And as I've been making my way week after week, it's feeling very timeless. And I was thinking to myself as I was in the final chapters, it kind of dawned on me, this story, I mean, we could definitely look deeper as to why I'm comparing it to this, but it reminds me of Mark Twain a little bit. I get such a timelessness feeling, for lack of a better phrase. I think about Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, and, you know, there are reasons why, of course. You know, we're in the South, we have amazing characters who are reminiscent of these classic iconic characters, but yeah, the E-Block squad of Brutal, Dean, Harry, Paul, and John Coffey, of course, they just give me that eternal feeling the way classic novels can, and it really touches my heart. But more gushing later. We've got to get down to business. We got a lot to do. So, ground rules, folks. If you are listening to this episode out of curiosity with my newest, that is A-okay. Definitely okay with us, but we highly encourage that you jump back to the beginning of the Green Mile coverage. There is still time to catch up and begin your trek down the mile with part 1 and get up to speed and hopefully enjoy these episodes as you're making your reread. There will be a few spoilers in my recap section, so definitely make sure you're up to date with your reading slash listening before you tune in, because I would hate to ruin anything for you. I really don't want to do that, especially if you're emotionally invested, which this novel will definitely make that a thing. So protect your heart and tread carefully, get caught up, and join us for part 5. So having said all that, let's do a quick recap of last week's coverage of The Green Mile Part 4, The Bad Death of Edouard Delacroix. So, sweet people, part 4 was definitely grim, as you know. But we had the miraculous, thank you God, thank you John Coffey, that Mr. Jingles, precious little mouse on the mile, was brought back to life after Percy, the human toilet Wetmore, smashed him with his shoe and killed him. So he came back, he was, you know, limping just a little bit, but he's back to normal, scooting down the Green Mile, being precious, he's okay, thank goodness. Next, we had a sadist, sociopath, serial killer in training. Percy Wetmore completely botched his portion of the Edouard execution via Old Sparky, and poor Edouard Delacroix, he roasted alive from the inside. Very sad, super gross, a very bad death in every sense of the word. It was rough. And lastly, rounding out part 4, we had the E-Block squad of Paul, Harry, Dean, and Brutal. They were at Paul's house having lunch. Joanna, his wife, made everybody sandwiches. And they were discussing a crazy plan where they were going to somehow get John Coffey to, in the proximity of, the warden's wife, Melinda Moores, who is dying of a brain tumor. So we were kind of left in those final moments with the gang hashing out a plan. And that brings us to today, part 5 of 6 within the Green Mile tale. This one is titled Night Journey, and we have an additional, let me get my page number in my skinny, skinny signet paperback. We are, like all the others, at 90 skinny, skinny paperback pages. I am once more using the individual signet paperbacks that were released in 1996. So the first one popped out in March of 96, so that would take us to July, I think. I probably totally screwed that math up, but we'll say July. So we're time traveling back to July of 96, where we just got our hands on part 5 of The Green Mile. Here is what happened in Night Journey. So we begin the story once more in the Georgia Pines Retirement Senior Living Facility. We've got our senior citizen Paul Edgecombe and his special friend Elaine Connolly. They are so cute together. I don't know about boyfriend, girlfriend, but they're definitely, there's a deep love there, I feel. At least maybe I just want it to be there, but they're really close. And the two of them hatch a plan to set off the smoke alarms so Paul can make his way to the barracks behind the facility in peace without getting any trouble or intervention from this super jerk named Brad Dolan. Brad Dolan is an employee at Georgia Pines. He's a total monster. He's a bully to Paul. He has actually physically assaulted Paul previously. It was terrible. But they set off the smoke alarm. It's pretty cheeky and charming, and Paul heads down to his secret place, because concerning that, what he does, where he goes, that part is a mystery to me. I watched the movie one time 20 years ago, so I don't remember. That's one part of the story I did not remember. There are a couple parts that I'll mention where I'm actually super in the dark. I don't remember at all. But as they pop up, I'll let you know. So after that, we jump back in time to 1932, where the E-Block squad have hatched a plan to sneak John Coffey out of the Green Mile and get him to Melinda Moore's so he can definitely heal her from her terminal brain tumor affliction. She only has, according to Paul's interactions with Warden Hal Moore's, a couple weeks. We are in the month of October in the story, and it's been said that she will die before Christmas. So the squad handles a local crazy town resident, Wild Bill Wharton. They take care of him with some sedated soda pop, and then, my favorite part, they rough up Percy Wetmore a little bit. They get him into a straitjacket, of which the reader discovers, and we're totally not surprised by it at all, that Percy is a giant little wimpy baby. He's a super brat who literally cries when he gets manhandled and demonstrates that he is the epitome of those who can dish it out but can't take it. And that is always so true, isn't it, folks? Like, the meanest people, like the mean, think of any bully in your life or like the most garbage person you know. When faced with their own medicine, they always cry the hardest and the loudest. Just a little 5 cents or 5 pence in that direction, because yeah, that it's totally true. But they sneak out John Coffey, who is totally ready to go. This is a very cool part because John Coffey has mysteriously read everybody's minds. He knows exactly what's going on. He knows the plan. It's very cool. He is ready to go. So they sneak him out, and it is midnight, of course. Lots of midnight around here. So I think Steve is using the traditional witching hour of midnight to bring in some plot changes and twists. So they sneak him out into the night, and John Coffey is thrilled. He is drinking in all the amazing nature around him. He is transfixed by the stars. It is so beautiful. It made me tear up a bit. It's just precious. And I'm drawing a blank on whether it was Harry's truck or Dean's truck. I think Dean might have been the one who had to stay behind and take care of everything. But they put everybody in the back of the truck, and this thing's kind of old and rickety, but they drive very slowly, 25 miles south, I believe, to Hal Moore's house. And it takes about an hour, so they kind of make their way. About an hour later, they arrive, but that entire time, John Coffey gets a delicious hour of outside night driving. He's loving every second. It's very sweet. It's October and it's a little chilly, so they're bundled up with army blankets. But when they arrive to Hal Moore's place, it's about 2-ish a.m. maybe almost 3 a.m., which would be the real witching hour. That's my witching hour. And he's in his PJs, he's got his gun drawn, and he is super confused as John Coffey and the guys are kind of approaching him. But thankfully, a kind of hypnotism occurs. It was the same kind of hypnotism that Paul Edgecombe speaks of in Mouse on the Mile. Oh no, sorry, it's in Coffey's Hands, Part 3. When he just kind of opens up John Coffey's cell door and sits down, and he doesn't understand why he did it. He just did it. He felt comforted and he felt like it was the right thing to do. So Hal Moore's kind of has a similar moment to Paul, and he just lets him in the house, and they head in, and oh, John Coffey, he gets to the bedside of Melinda Moore's, and folks, holy crap, she looks like death warmed up, you guys. She is knocking on death's door, and the text speaks of her withered, her skin is hanging off her bones, she's gaunt, she looks old. She is just a horror. She's an absolute ghoul of this disease destroying her. And what's also very uncomfortable for the reader, but it's strangely perplexing, I'm going to talk more about it in the next section, is that Melinda is saying some really sort of crass, inappropriate, very sordid, like, it's filthy. Like, the things that are coming out of her mouth are very terrible. And it's 1,000% not who she is, and it's, you could tell, like, Hal Moore's super emotionally exhausted, and so John Coffey gets in there, he kneels beside her, and it's a very intriguing exchange, folks, because John Coffey kind of literally breathes this demon slash tumor out of her. The scene in which the physicalness of it is pretty wild. He's kind of inhaling it, he's sucking it out, she's kind of, the breath she's expelling, it's pretty wild. We're gonna talk more about it in the next section because it's huge, but there is a quite literal earthquake that occurs with a grandfather clock falling over, bed shaking and smoking to the point where Paul has to pour a pitcher of water on top of the coverlet. Like, there is some stuff happening, dear friends. But Melinda Moores is quickly back to her old self again. The life rushes back into her. The youth, she has rosy cheeks. She is, the reader can assume, 100% healed from the brain tumor. And she is coherent and sweet and loving, and it's a beautiful moment. However, John Coffey, per the other healing moments we had with him, he is not coughing up the bugs, the black noceums, the flittering bugs that he expels after he does a healing. He's not able to cough it up. He's coughing quite a bit, but he can't get it up. And Paul writes that John is not looking good. He's looking gray and ashen and sick. So we as the reader are terribly concerned. But they head back to the Green Mile, to Cold Mountain Prison, right as the sun is coming up. And that's when this installment ends, right as they are getting back to the Green Mile. So, whew, oh my gosh, you guys, this was very rich. This is, we got a lot going on in Night Journey. We have a lot of physicalness. We've got a bunch of parts moving, people moving. This was an amazing chunk, and I am feeling all the things I'm feeling. The miraculous healing of Melinda is insane, guys. It's insane. And I'm going to talk a lot about it in the next section. So I think we're ready to head that way. So how it's going to work is for our next section, we are going to examine a chunk of text from part 5 that I thought was quite lovely. I want to share it with everybody. And then we're going to look at 2 areas of Night's Journey that I feel have some very strong symbolism attached to them. And we're also going to unpack how what happened in Melinda's bedroom is, I think, very close to a very cool short story within The Bazaar of Bad Dreams. So more on that in the next section. I will see you there. Alright, everybody, let's unpack this very stuffed suitcase of part 5 Night Journey. I have some really awesome things to discuss with all of you, but we're going to start with exploring the text a little bit. I have a really beautiful example I want to share with all of you, and surprisingly, it's at the very beginning of the story. typically throughout these five parts, I found some really beautiful writing as the story was meaty and deep in plot and definitely towards the latter half. But starting Night Journey, this part was so beautiful. This opener was so rich. I found myself reading it a few times, and that's how I know. I know it's a winner when I keep going back to it. So we're going to start off with an example from the text, and then I have not one, but two topics I'd like to explore with you guys a little bit more. We're going to go deeper and further into some ideas that I think King puts in this story. It definitely got me thinking. So stay tuned for those two coming up after this reading segment. So if you have your Signet paperback copy from 1996, we are starting on page one. Well, it's actually page seven, but chapter one, page seven. Oh, let us absorb this beautiful, melancholy narration, gorgeous storytelling. I love how King is sort of giving the reader a very poetic recap, but also letting us draw nearer to Paul. So let's get into it. Mr. H.G. Wells once wrote a story about a man who invented a time machine, and I have discovered that, in the writing of these memoirs, I have created my own time machine. Unlike Wells's, it can only travel into the past, back to 1932, as a matter of fact, when I was the Bull Goose Screw in E Block of Cold Mountain State Penitentiary, but it's eerily efficient for all that. Still, this time machine reminds me of the old Ford I had in those days. You could never be sure if it would start eventually, but you never knew if a turn of the key would be enough to fire the motor, or if you were going to have to get out and crank until your arm practically fell off. I've had a lot of easy starts since I started telling the story of John Coffey, but yesterday I had to crank. I think it was because I'd gotten to Delacroix's execution, and part of my mind didn't want to have to relive that. It was a bad death, a terrible death, and it happened the way it did because of Percy Wetmore, a young man who loved to comb his hair but couldn't stand to be laughed at, not even by a half-bald little Frenchman who was never going to see another Christmas. As with most dirty jobs, however, the hardest part is just getting started. It doesn't matter to an engine whether you use the key or have to crank. Once you get it going, it'll usually run just as sweet either way. That's how it worked for me yesterday. At first, the words came out in little bursts of phrasing, then in whole sentences, then a torrent. Writing is a special and rather terrifying form of remembrance. I've discovered that there's a totality to it that seems almost like rape. Perhaps I only feel that way because I've become a very old man, a thing that happened behind my own back, I sometimes feel. But I don't think so. I believe that the combination of pencil and memory creates a kind of practical magic, and magic is dangerous. As a man who knew John Coffey and saw what he could do to mice and to men, I feel very qualified to say that. Magic is dangerous. In any case, I wrote all day yesterday, the words simply flooding out of me, the sunroom of this glorious old folks' home gone, replaced by the storage room at the end of the Green Mile where so many of my problem children took their last sit-me-downs, and the bottom of the stairs which led to the tunnel under the road. That's where Dean and Harry and Brutal and I confronted Percy Wetmore over Edouard Delacroix's smoking body and made Percy renew his promise to put in for transfer to the Briar Ridge State Mental Facility. There are always fresh flowers in the sunroom. But by noon yesterday, all I could smell was the noxious aroma of the dead man's cooked flesh. The sound of the power mower on the lawn down below had been replaced by the hollow plink of dripping water as it seeped slowly through the tunnel's curved roof. The trip was on. I had traveled back to 1932 in soul and mind, if not body. Oh, swoon. Oh, friends, I just love, love, love a melancholy-filled narrator, the King narrator that we all know and love, who is reporting back from years long lived, full of wisdom and perhaps regret, and there's so much emotion and hindsight and amazing narration. So, what do you think? I'd love to know your thoughts on some of this gorgeous writing, but let us now take entrance into my first topic that I'd like to talk to you guys about. This one is titled The Speedy Influence of Godlike Power. All right, so here we go. So, dear friends, what made me kind of create this topic is I was thinking of basically how quickly our narrator Paul Edgecombe has moved since these miracles have occurred. For example, I think that Paul Edgecombe, the second that he received these miracles, his urinary tract infection was healed, he saw a dead Mr. Jingles brought back to life. Paul is spinning, dear friends, and he is moving quickly. Right away, he has hatched a plot to get John Coffey to heal Melinda Moores. And this is our first of many biblical allusions. We're going to go to Sunday school for just a few minutes. I promise it's not going to be traumatic, nor will it be preachy or anything negative, merely educational. So I couldn't help but think of a story in the Bible that is most commonly referred to as the healing of the paralytic at Capernaum. So this is a very cool story. If you guys spent any time in Sunday school in your lives, you might have heard it, but it very, very much reminds me of what Paul and the E-Block squad do with John Coffey. So jumping to the Bible for a quick second, we've got, this story is such a big deal, folks. We have it repeated in three Gospels. We have Matthew, Mark, and Luke all recounting the same story. So we got three different people confirming that this in fact happened. So it's a really cool one where you have a bunch of friends who had a friend of theirs who was completely paralyzed. This guy could not move. And I guess through the grapevine, they heard there was this guy named Yeshua, and he was from Nazareth, and he was healing people, like legit healing people. People had seen some crazy stuff. So they're like, oh my God, he can heal our friend. And so their friend was paralyzed, and they had him on like a little mat. It was basically a straw little heap, almost like a desiccated carpet, if you will. And everybody is around Jesus. He's a very popular guy. He's hanging out at somebody's place. There are people everywhere. Nobody can get in. He is surrounded. You can't even get close to him. Nothing. So these friends, who are so desperate, they just want to see if their friend could be healed. They get up on the roof and they cut a hole in the roof and they lower their friend down through the hole right in front of Jesus. And Jesus talks with the guy and says, if you believe, pick up your mat and walk. I heal you and forgive your sins. This also gets Jesus in a little bit of hot water with the Sanhedrin, with the Pharisees, who were not okay with anybody but God forgiving sins. More on that another time. But this is an amazing story where they cut a hole in the roof, which must have taken a minute, but they had such belief, or hope rather, that their friend could be healed by this guy from Nazareth. So they chopped a hole in the roof, kind of lowered him down on a very ramshackle conveyor, and their friend was healed, and he picked up his mat and walked home. Pure miracle. So we have that mentioned in three Gospels, and I couldn't help but think about how that is what our E-Block squad does a little bit. They are risking not only their jobs at the prison, but becoming inmates themselves, dear friends. Like, this is huge. This is absolutely humongous. They could be, and Paul kind of tries to reiterate this once or twice to the gang, like, you don't have to do this. Like, this is really dangerous. But all of them have kind of seen and or heard, directly witnessed the miraculous hands of John Coffey, especially regarding Mr. Jingles the Mouse. So this is some compelling stuff. And there also might be some mystical influence as well. We have in several parts of the story mentioned that Paul kind of felt a peaceful hypnosis where he didn't understand why he was doing it. It just felt right. It was just a kind of gentle compulsion. The same thing happens with Hal Moores, who had his gun drawn as John Coffey was climbing the steps of his porch, and yet he just kind of lowered it and let him pass into his home. And so we also, in that same moment, we have, I believe it's Harry, who steps in front of John Coffey. Hal Moores has his gun drawn, and Harry steps in front. I would bet money it's Harry. I think it's Harry. Harry's truck, and Harry steps in front of John to protect him and says to Hal, "I know it's crazy, but we just want to help. We're here to help." And Paul explains that to the reader. Like, everyone is compelled in a very strange way. It's as if this is much bigger than all of them. And that's a very fascinating thing to explore, dear friends. Like, there's something very mystical, very potentially divine, but it's something good. And there doesn't seem to be any lingering effects of this influence. It's a peaceful surrender of will, and it's when in proximity to John Coffey. And that is a very interesting spiritual concept surrounding this text, especially when we look at the character of John Coffey, who I mentioned in part 3 is so messianic, guys. He is extremely special. He's incredible. He is a Christ-like character that King is working with. More on that in next week's episode. But I couldn't help but think of the healing of the paralytic at Capernaum in regards to the healing of Melinda Moores. This gang hustled, dear friends. Immediately they hatched a plan. They did not turn back, even though they got scared. They were nervous because Wild Bill wakes up for a second. The plan is most definitely almost foibled. He reaches out and grabs John Coffey's arm, and if he remembers anything, they're screwed. I'm actually very nervous. Percy's been, you know, straitjacketed. He's gonna sing like a canary to his government friends, who, because he's a sniveling little weasel. So they are risking so much. They are risking their employment, which they're still in the grips of the Great Depression. So having a job is extremely dire. Keeping a job is even more, like, it's life and death if you don't have a job in this time in American history. And yet they're doing it because they believe. They believe and they have seen. And I don't know about those guys in Capernaum, what they knew or what they saw, but enough to sell it to their other buddies to say, "We can't get in to see this Jesus guy. Get on the roof. Like, we gotta do something. We have to try. We have to get him to this guy from Nazareth. Like, let's go on the roof. Let's freaking cut a hole in the roof. Like, this is amazing." And so I love this, guys. And I love that. I wonder if King is doing that a little bit. Just kind of showing that when people observe the miraculous, observe the unexplainable, the divine, the how did you do that? How is this possible? How is this real? It opens up the world to them because they realize, especially concerning our narrator, Paul Edgecombe, they have the power to change the outcome. All of a sudden, they might be able to control something, which that's what all humans want, right? We just want to control the uncontrollable and influence what we can't influence. But when you witness the ineffable, the absolutely mind-bogglingly, how did that happen? And you are able to manipulate the source a little bit. oh yeah, like you're gonna move very fast and you are going to absolutely surrender to the allure of influencing whatever you can. If you could make a difference, if you can make an impact, you're going to do it and you're gonna move fast. And I love that. And it kind of, in a more sort of philosophical tangent, we won't stray too far, but it kind of highlights the sort of good nature of mankind. Like, mankind is inherently good. Maybe? Question mark? I don't know. That's a big chunk. We won't do too much of that. But the fact that Paul does not do this for personal gain, but for someone else, it's amazing. It's amazing that if human beings have the power to help or to bring healing or any kind of benevolent goodwill to someone else, it could just be that Paul's a good person and good people will become more good, bad people might become more bad, potentially. You know, if Paul was a more villainous character, he might have used John Coffey's abilities for personal gain or for some sort of nefarious purpose, who knows, but I don't know if it would work like that, because John Coffey is a divine character. There is something incredibly celestial about him that we're going to unpack more in part 6. But this is fascinating, guys, and there's a lot of biblical stuff going on. It's stewing in the stew pot. It's bubbling in the cauldron. So we should say this is cooking up some very amazing things in terms of biblical allusion and what King is doing with this story. So, that's my first point, the speedy influence of godlike power. So, take a look at the E-Block squad and the entire scene. Notice how swiftly it comes together. Notice how swiftly they get John Coffey on board, knowing that it is in the service for someone else. They all are racing to try and help, risking their jobs, risking their very freedoms to try and help someone who they really don't know all that well, but they know that she's a good woman who doesn't deserve the fate that she's been dealt. And if they're able to see the miraculous and have seen it, let's do it again. And so there's a lot with that, guys. So if you have been hesitating reading The Green Mile up until this point, or you just can't get into it, please give it a try. This stuff is really cooking by the time you get to part 5. There's some genius level stuff going on here, some really important, rich narration and narrative content, and I can keep going and going and going. But this next one is even better. So my number 2 point that I want to discuss further with all of you guys is concerning Melinda's brain tumor, and I'm titling this The Evil of Illness. So one thing that happened to me when I was reading part 5, Night Journey, and we get to Melinda's house, and we overhear the things that are coming out of her mouth, and it is very inappropriate, guys. Like, if you have young listeners in the car, I'm not gonna say what Melinda says, because I don't even like saying these words. Like, it's very ugly language. It's sordid, it's perverted, it's crass. And at first I was really uncomfortable with it, even after all this time reading King. Like, I'm still like, ew, like why are you making her speak like that? And then the more I thought about it, I was like, I get it. I thought about The Exorcist, you know? I thought about the movie where this young, innocent, pure virginal girl, Reagan, is taken over by a demon, and what kind of things did he make her say? Horrific things! Like, things that if you guys think about that movie, you know what I'm talking about. You're never gonna unhear what you heard Reagan say. Because that's kind of what evil does. It's blaspheming, it's inappropriate, it's shocking. And so at first I was struggling with it, but then I realized what King was trying to say. And this is very telling, given the fact that a few years later, we have King's accident, where he undergoes years of rehabilitative therapy and pain, But what I think I'm observing in this, and what I think we can unpack a little bit, is how King is saying that sometimes malignant illnesses, terminal illnesses, they are such, they're so debilitating and merciless, they're evil. They are absolutely evil. I mean, there are some evil diseases out there, friends. I don't know, Lou Gehrig's disease, like horrifying diseases that absolutely make, they destroy families. They absolutely wither a bright, vibrant life to just a frail little husk. And the spirit and soul is long gone, and there's this monstrous, evil little presence that is saying these shocking, terrible things. And I think that King is kind of allowing this illness to be evil. This tumor in her brain is an evil thing. This is as malevolent as you could get. It has destroyed her, and it keeps taking and taking greedily, and now it's making her character just a barely visible shadow. She's gone, which is so taxing on the warden, Hal Moores. It is so upsetting. And so when John Coffey comes in there and he's in the presence of this evil, the way that King describes it is very much like The Exorcist. There is shaking, there is flame and smoke and things crashing. Like, this is an entity that did not want to leave its host. And John Coffey is taking it into himself, because he is just this selfless, wonderful person who's trying to help. And even though we don't know yet, we as the reader don't know yet at what cost, but the evil of illness, Melinda's brain tumor, is evil. And I love that we have this shocking scene, and we have a very kind of violent exit where this thing screams. It sounds like an eagle screech. It sounds quite terrifying, quite menacing. Paul says that all of the E-Block squad hear different things. They hear the screech of an animal caught in a trap or a wolf howl. Like, there is some very sinister, evil stuff that is going down with the removal of this tumor. This thing did not want to go peacefully. And so if you're looking at it from a purely like anatomical, you know, insignificant, there's nothing mystical associated with it, it's just, you know, a malignant mass that keeps on growing, you know, it would lose the power, and in terms of, it would just be a more medical anomaly that is destroying brain tissue. And, you know, there's all kinds of logical, empirical reasons why the brain tumor would be making Melinda speak like that. But if we're looking at it from a more spiritual side or a more superstitious side, we can observe, and it's quite accurate, this brain tumor is evil, and it's a source of hellish agony and pain and suffering, but it's also, it's trying to destroy her soul, you know, by destroying her character, by making her disappear completely. So I kind of like that King went really rated R with it. He just went really out there to make the reader uncomfortable, to make the E-Block squad uncomfortable, to really break the heart of Hal Moores by making her say these really sordid and inappropriate graphic things, very much like in The Exorcist, when we have young Reagan being flopped around and abused, and the horrific things that come out of that girl's mouth, right? It's shocking. Language is shocking, and it's written that, you know, demonic influence, it's anything it's very black and white. All demon or any kind of demonic entity is the antithesis of anything holy or good. Ergo, it's constantly going to bring about anything to blaspheme the name of God or to harm his children, aka us, human beings, humanity. So anything they could do, whether it's through language, physical torture of the body, affliction, anything that can harm us, they're gonna do it. And so I think that this language is alienating Melinda from her husband, from the world. He can't take her outside. He's embarrassed because of her. So there's, you know, there's just this private, painful, dying filled room, and it's frightening and evil and as terrifying as you could get if you think about it. This lady's wasting away. It's full of, you know, she can't control her bowels very well, so it's incredibly unpleasant to smell. She's unpleasant to be around. It's just alienating all the love she had in her life, and that's evil. That is so evil. So I really like what King did there. It took me a minute to kind of figure it out and observe why he did that, because I was offended. I really was. I was curious as to why he would have her say these things, but I really, really like that he did. And this leads me to a short story that it immediately reminded me of. So you guys can jump back. I believe it's my part two episode of The Bazaar of Bad Dreams. I really liked one in there. I believe it was written in the early 2010s, either 2010 or 2011. It was later input into The Bazaar of Bad Dreams. This one is called The Little Green God of Agony. And I would love for you guys to read this and maybe to read the scene featuring Melinda Moores. This is cool. Granted, the Little Green God of Agony is much more personal to King, as he mentioned, having an addiction to painkillers after his accident, all of the pain of rehabilitative therapy after all of his injuries were healing and all of the things. So it's definitely more graphic, but when we have the scene with Melinda Moores right next to the short story, The Little Green God of Agony, interesting. It's very cool. So if the kind of pseudo-exorcism of Melinda Moore's tumor was entertaining for you, please, 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 if you haven't, jump over to The Bazaar of Bad Dreams and check out The Little Green God of Agony. It is very cool, starts off very unexpectedly, and then wow, does it take a super gothic turn. Very cool, creepy-rific, a great Halloween read. But it's also saying a lot about illness, specifically pain, as well as how very much kind of rounding out my point, the evil of illness, like the evil of bodily affliction. There's some evil behind that, guys, and that's my theory. That's my theory. I'm going to expand on this further, as I'm sure more King works will pop up that remind me of it, but I'm thinking I will definitely have the scene with Melinda Moores in my mind going forward for a while. It is very well done. It is very visual. It's powerful. It's absolutely wild. Very reminiscent of The Exorcist. Or, you know, not exactly as graphic, but this is alive. This scene has definitely some action-packed exorcism-like moments. It's pretty intense. Check out The Little Green God of Agony, which kind of piggybacks off of this a little bit, I think. If there are other exorcism scenes in King works, please let me know. I'm really interested. It's kind of got me thinking a little bit here in terms of analyzing what King is doing. So that's all I have. So number one, my point to recap, the speedy influence of godlike power, and number two, the evil of illness. I observed both within part five, Night Journey, and if anybody wants to read the quick story of healing the paralytic at Capernaum, I think it works. I think it works in terms of the E-Block squad and how desperate all of them were to get John Coffey out of prison into the dead of night in a rickety old pickup truck driving along the forest highway trying to heal the warden's wife. So lots of amazing, powerful, in all caps, content in part 5, Night Journey. Okay, that leads us to the best part, which I forgot last week, the trivia questions. So if you guys have been following along with my Green Mile coverage, in the Signet paperbacks, if we were around in 1996, if we were interested in entering the Green Mile contest, in which 36 winners would have received an autographed Stephen King library. Holy crap. I must know if anybody won it. Please let me know if you were one of the lucky fellows in 1996 who wrote in by mail to the postal, it's a P.O. box in Medford, New York. So let me know. I'm dying to know if anybody won. But last week I forgot to read the question. For part 4, this one's a little bit of a dud, I think, but for last week's question, which was part 4, The Bad Death of Edouard Delacroix, it asks, Brad Dolan, the orderly at Georgia Pines, reminds the narrator of Percy Wetmore. What similarities do the two of them share? Write your answer on a separate piece of paper in 50 words or less. I would have wrote in, duh, like, that's dumb. Like, that's a dumb question. They're the exact same person. All right, part 5, our question for to be one of 36 winners. Oh no, 36 winners total, not one of 36, amazing. This week's question, the narrator, Paul Edgecombe, has a strange dream on the way back from Warden Moore's house. What do you think the dream means? Ooh, I like that one. I forgot to talk to you guys about that. That was another biblical allusion we have in this part. When Paul is kind of dozing a little bit, he has a dream where he is holding a bloody hammer. And he sees, of course, Edouard Delacroix on the cross next to a John Coffey. I'm drawing a blank on the other person on the cross because there were three people crucified at Golgotha on the crucifixion day. But he is a centurion, and he uses that exact word, a Roman centurion, aka the people who did the crucifying, who hammered the nails into the thieves and into the hands and feet of Jesus. So he's seeing himself as a Roman centurion, perhaps in what he is about to do or what he has done to these people on E-Block. So that might have been more than 50 words, but do you think I could have won if I wrote that down? Okay, dear ones, this has been amazing. I am loving this novel, loving it. Oh my God. So what we're gonna do for next week, part 6, which is the end, the last one, I believe it's called Coffee on the Mile. I could be getting that wrong. I hope I'm not. Part 6, Coffee on the Mile. We're going to go all out. We are going to have the best episode ever with lots of coverage, lots of expansion. Hopefully, I will have some time to watch the 1999 film directed by His Holiness Frank Darabont. I'm gonna do it, I'm gonna watch it, I'm gonna cry the entire time, because when I think about watching the movie, I already start to cry, and I haven't even pressed play. Like, that's... So I might just have to sit by myself on the couch and feel the pain and watch that beautiful film to close out this amazing novel. We're gonna make it happen. I hope I can have it done in time. If not, please forgive any delays, and it will be done soon. I promise, because I'm having the best time ever. But as we say farewell for now, if you would be so kind and lovely and beautiful and sweet to head over to Apple Podcasts and give the show a 5-star review. That would mean the world. I would love to meet some more King readers for the Halloween season as well as the rest of 2021. I would love to make some new friends. If you haven't already, please write into the show and say hi, underratedsk@gmail.com. Let's exchange some thoughts on King. And if you want, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at underratedskpod. So I hope to be with you again soon to conclude this stellar, gorgeous novel composed in 6 parts. It's been a joy. It has been a magical time. And I hope you've been enjoying the journey as well. I hope you guys have done your reread to catch up with me. I'd love to hear from you wherever you are in the world. Enjoy this lovely month of October. Please take care, and I'll talk to you soon.